Greetings to everybody who's joined so far. We're going to start at maybe 3 or 4 minutes past the hour until some of the beeps have calmed down. This conference will be muted, and if you do have a question, we ask that you use the web interface to raise your hand, and we will be able to answer your question via that mechanism. We'll get started shortly. So greetings everyone and welcome to the Globus Online and ESVET webinar. We are going to get started in about a minute or two with our presenters. We are going to keep this conference muted to all participants so that the presenters can work in an environment that allows them to present. At the end of the conference, we will open it up to questions. If you have a question any time before we get started, we ask that you please use the web interface to raise your hand, and then we can then acknowledge and answer your question via the chat or via the presenter can answer your question. So today we have four speakers. We have Brian Tierney from ESVET. We have Steve Tiki from University of Chicago and Argonne National Lab. Andrew McElrone from University of California, Davis. And Yasmin Carter from the University of Saskatchewan. And we're going to discuss a little bit about networking and a little bit about the use of Globus Online to enable life sciences. So we're going to get started first with Brian Tierney. And he's going to present a little bit of an overview on ESNet, some network architecture preliminaries, and then we will move into the more specific discussion about how Globus Online works. So Brian, I believe you're unmuted. If you'd like to take it away, it is all yours.
Okay, great. Can you hear me?
I can hear you.
Great. Okay, and if I click next slide, you should now all see the next slide. Is that right?
Correct.
Yes.
Great. Okay. Okay, so welcome, everybody. This is Brian Tierney from ESNet, and I'm going to start out by giving just a little bit of a brief overview of what is ESNet and sort of how this notion of the science DMZ came about before we jump into the description of Globus Online. So ESNet is the high-performance network that links all the Department of Energy laboratories together. Actually, I don't really know how many of you who are on this call work for labs and how many of you are at universities, but I'm assuming at least many of you are familiar with ESNet, at least at some level. The things that are unique about ESNet, though, is that it's really engineered for high bandwidth data flows, and that we are a completely 100 gigabit backbone. The other thing that's really important to know about ESNet, though, is that most of our traffic actually leaves ESNet. Most collaboration between DOE labs are not necessarily between two labs, but between one lab and one or more universities. So the data flow, a lot of data comes and goes from ESNet. It ends up going over, a lot of it ends up traveling over Internet 2 in the process and other networks. So it's a more difficult problem to make sure your high bandwidth data flows work when there's multiple networks involved. And the other thing that's starting to keep a lot of folks up at night here around ESNet is just how much data we're going to need to deal with in the not-too-distant future. ESNet has been experiencing logarithmic growth since we started monitoring things back in 1990, and this is showing no signs of letting up. And as you can see, this is a log scale on the left side of the plot. So, exponential growth forever leads to big problems, and we're starting to get nervous about this for sure. So traditionally, there are certain scientific groups who have relied on physical media for moving their data around. There's a fair number of science disciplines where they copy their data to portable USB drives and, you know, take them on a plane with them or ship them out. But there's a whole lot of fields that this just will no longer scale. The size of the data sets will no longer fit on portable media, and this is just not going to be something that's going to work in the future. And another thing to point out is that the way ESNet engineers our wide area network is it really is engineered for big flows. People talk about elephant flows versus flows in the network. And actually the problem is that elephant flows will step on the mice flows. But in our network, we really go through a lot of effort to traffic engineer things such to try to separate the elephant flows from the mice flows wherever possible and to optimize for the mice flows or for the elephant flows as well. But the problem is often campus networks are in fact not engineered for the elephant flows, and that's a problem. Again, a lot of times people are using FedEx, also known as SneakerNet, for shipping their data around. And that's often because of the perception that it's actually faster. But it's really not, and at least not if things are architected correctly. Local networks are just often not designed for high-speed science flows, and often people are using the wrong tools. Often they tried using the network 5 years ago, and it didn't work, and they switched to shipping disks, and they haven't tried since. So we're really trying to educate people to rethink that as a solution. So one of the things we're trying to do is to sort of raise people's expectations of what the network is capable of. These days, a lot of people have 1 gigabit networks to their office, and a gigabit network, assuming your disks are fast enough, will only take about 3 hours to copy a terabyte. That's very, very reasonable. We want to encourage people to think of a terabyte as something that's not hard, because in fact, it's not. You do potentially have to have some RAID disks. It's not necessarily going to get that to your laptop, really, a terabyte is not that hard anymore. On a 10-gig network, a terabyte's only 20 minutes. And compare that to the amount of time it takes to actually copy a terabyte onto a portable hard drive. Typically, it's somewhere around a day We've heard anything from 15 to 40 hours to load a terabyte onto portable media. So the network should be much, much faster, and people should by default be trying to use the network. But there's a lot of things that get in the way. Here's an example of some performance through a firewall. There's a lot of firewalls out there that have performance issues. Here, the top graph shows performance—it's incoming versus outgoing through a performance—and it was 20 times slower in the direction of incoming because it was going through the firewall. By bypassing the firewall, the lower graph shows that you can get much, much better performance, basically a full 1 gigabit per second line rate. And of course, 10 gig networks, this is even more of a problem. And a big part of the problem, too, is called soft failures. A lot of times, networks are dropping packets silently, and nobody knows about it, nobody notices it. Most campus network monitoring tools are really good at noticing if the network is down, but they are much less good if noticing a small amount of packet loss. And here's some data from an actual case in ESnet where we had some failing optical device in a router that was dropping 1 out of 22,000 packets. And one might think, oh, 1 out of 22,000 packets, that's really not a big deal, right? Well, on a local area network, it turns out that's not a big deal. The performance dropped from 9.8 to 7.3 gigs because of that. But because of the way TCP works and the way TCP interprets loss as congestion, and this wasn't congestion, of course, this was just loss from bad hardware, TCP backs off rather dramatically as the round trip time goes up. So as you can see on a cross-country link, it ends up being 16 times slower than the performance you would achieve if you weren't dropping 1 out of 22,000 packets. So for big data flows, people need to architect their networks to not drop packets, and they need to monitor for this type of packet loss. Because in this particular case, it was only noticed by doing some active performance monitoring using some tools that are part of the PerfSonar toolkit that we noticed this problem. The router itself did not report this loss at all. So the next thing that's really important is to use the right tool. And we've been telling people for years now, do not use SCP. It's just not designed for this. It has its own internal windowing. It does not scale over long-distance networks. So this slide shows that if you use the proper tool, such as GridFTP, that you're going to hear more about next in Globus Online, you can get easily over 5 gigabits per second, where SCP can only do 140 megabits per second. There's a patched version of SCP that comes out of Pittsburgh Supercomputer Center called HPN, High Performance Network Patched HCP, which helps quite a bit, but it's still not good enough. And in fact, at the 6.6 gigs reported in this slide, that's actually disk limited at the right side. I ran some more recent tests that showed 8-stream grid FTP could do 9.8 gigs, no problem, just writing to memory. I didn't happen to have a disk array that was fast enough in this particular case to do faster than that. So tools like GridFTP can scale to the speeds of your disk, whereas tools like SCP will not be able to do that. So due to all these problems that we've noticed over the years, things like firewalls, things like packet loss, things like people using the wrong tool, ESnet has come up with this network design pattern, network architecture, we call the Science DMZ. And the Science DMZ is specifically designed to make it easy to avoid these problems and reduce the likelihood of these problems. Fundamentally, there's three components to the Science DMZ. One is a properly configured and tuned data transfer node, or DTN, that's really optimized for things like this, that has the right tools on it, things like Globus Online, that has the right tuning settings, and there's a number of things you have to tune to get high performance. And and clearly has the right speed disk as well, the right kind of RAID systems, so that the disk isn't your bottleneck. The second component is the right network architecture, where ideally you place this as close to your border router as possible. Ideally, you place it outside the firewall and use router ACLs to protect it instead. And ideally, there's as few of hops as possible that could potentially have packet loss on them. And then the third component is the ability to actually do regular active testing and measurement on this network, and we recommend the open source Personar tools for that. So the next slide is just a picture of what a typical simple CINCD DMZ might look like, where the high-speed data path goes straight to the data transfer node in the lower left, bypassing the firewall. Traffic inside the campus still is protected by the firewall, but it's the only things that are outside the firewall are very, very restricted set of services. You know, no email, nothing sensitive. It's just services for large data flows. And CINCDMZ may take many forms. It depends on what your campus looks like. It depends on where the data resources are and where you need to get the data to and from. But that's just a very simple example. But many universities and labs are now in the process of creating science DMZs. National Science Foundation's CCNIE program has been funding several campuses to build science DMZs. They funded about, 15 or 20 campuses last year, and they're funding another 15 or 20 campuses this year to build science DMZs on campus. So this idea is really catching on. And Globus Online, GridFTP are really sort of a key component of the CINCDMZ, and one of the most important things is on your data transfer node to be using tools that can actually keep up, and Globus is one of those tools. It also provides all the key features really necessary for this environment. It supports parallel streams, things like auto restart. It has all the necessary security modules that people might be interested in. It has firewall NAT traversal, and it has become very, very easy to install and configure recently as well. Steve, of course, will go into a lot more details on that. The one other thing I wanted to point out is that ESNet actually runs three public anonymous 10 gigabit GridFTP test hosts, where you can do anonymous read-only GridFTP to find out what your network, what your campus is capable of as far as sucking down things over GridFTP. There's a URL at the bottom that has some sample commands you can use. You can also do this through Globus Online. These are all Globus Online endpoints as well. And we find a lot of people find these very, very useful for testing. I can get 5 gigabits per second from the ESNet server, why aren't I able to get 5 gigabits per second from your server, kind of thing. We have a lot more information online. Our website, fasterdata.es.net, has many, many pages that go into lots of detail on the CINCDMZ, on data transfer nodes, on how to tune your data transfer nodes, et cetera. And we recently had a paper accepted for SC13 that is now publicly available as well. So I'm going to now, I think I've used up my 15 minutes, and we can move on to Steve. I don't know if you want to save questions to the very end, Jason.
Why don't we save questions to the very end, unless anybody would like to type them into the chat room. But I believe that we can move on to, or start to move on to Steve so that he's ready to prepare. If you want to take over the screen, Steve, you can do so.
All right. Thank you. So this is Steve Hickey from University of Chicago and Argonne National Laboratory. So I'll spend the next 15 minutes or so talking about Globus Online, a couple quick slides to set the intro, but then I'll actually do a live demo so you can see it in action, get a good feel for what it does. So, you know, as Brian just talked about, you know, we have you know, in the research world, we are blessed with high-speed networks, and Brian's slides, you know, very clearly make the case for, you know, the networks, the systems can handle the high-speed transfers, right? So it really should be easy for us to move around a lot of data, right? My kids are every day streaming gigabytes to my house with Netflix. Why isn't it that easy for us in the science world to move our data around from our science instruments to our collaborators, to our analysis systems, into repositories, these sorts of things? Now, of course, if you've never done this much, you know that there are all sorts of problems that get in our way, right? And Brian talked about some of them at the more networking level, the firewalls and these sorts of stuff, but there's also a lot of things at more of the software layer around things like security credentials and, you know, big systems pieces fail. Networks maybe fail, servers fail, so being able to auto restart on these sorts of things. So what our mission is in Globus Online is to say, okay, we've got the underlying systems through the networks like ESNet and Internet 2 and Science DMZs. What we need is the tools to go with it that makes it really easy to leverage those networks to do what we need to do. And so, you know, in a nutshell, what Globus Online is it provides a big data and sharing service with Dropbox-like simplicity directly from your own stored systems. So what I'll show is sort of pick that apart and actually show it in action here in a second. So there's two main use cases, I guess at this point you can think of, that we support with Globus Online. The first is a managed file transfer and synchronization service. We run Globus Online from the University of Chicago as a service to the nonprofit research community. And the model is that, you know, it's software as a service. It's just like cloud services like Gmail or Netflix or anything like that, where as a user, I log in via my browser to this cloud service, initiate my request, sort of hand off my request to that cloud service, say, here's what I want to do. And Globus Online will then mediate the transfer between the source and the destination. The data will not flow through Globus Online. That'll all go directly from your source to destination, so we can get all the advantages of these great networks that are being built. But we can monitor it, manage it, recover when there's faults, all this sort of stuff, and also navigate the complex security environments across institutions and national laboratories and these sorts of things in a nice fashion for you. The second major use case is sharing. You know, the first one was about, you know, I've got accounts at different systems, an account at NERSC on my supercomputing center, my department cluster, my laptop, right, and I can move data amongst those accounts of mine at various sites. But the biggest feature we've been asked for since we introduced that a couple of years ago was, okay, that's nice, but what about sharing? Can I allow my data to be made available to somebody else so that they can download it from my account without needing a local account on my system? You know, for all the same reasons that probably most of you use Dropbox for sharing things like Word files and PDFs and small things, we want that same level of simplicity for sharing our big data, and that's what this capability is really about. And as I mentioned, we operate this as software as a service to the community that we operate at University of Chicago. Like any SaaS offers a web interface. We have a very nice command line interface for if you want to do scripting or other command line usage. We also have a REST interface behind all this if you want to do deeper integration. But we run this as a service with help desk support, troubleshooting. We're constantly updating the service with new features and capabilities. And then, of course, with a service like Globus Online that's about connecting your storage systems, we need easy ways to take your own systems everywhere your data might be, whether it's on your own personal machines, your lab servers, your campus clusters, your supercomputing centers, and connect those into the Globus Cloud so that it can actually do its thing. And for that, we have a family of tools we call Globus Connect, and I'll show you that as well. So with that, why don't we go ahead and do a demonstration? So let me share my desktop here. And you should be seeing a browser login. So what we've had here is, you know, this is a standard Mac laptop, no additional software installed beyond the normal stuff. And I'm using Chrome browser, so it works with any standard browser, Chrome, IE, Firefox, Safari. So I go to globusonline.org, and there's lots of good information up here in the menus if you want to see facts and case studies. Let's go ahead and get moving with it. So as software as a service, as you'd hopefully expect, the first thing you need to do is sign up. You get an account, and getting an account is quick and easy, right? You just type in your name and email, and you can pick a username, and if it doesn't exist, it'll give you some options you can choose from, and passwords, which, you know, if you want to show it or not, make sure you didn't mistype. Agree to terms of service. We promise we won't spam you, and then hit register, and it'll take literally just a couple seconds to set up your account. And you'll get an email to verify, you know, your email address you typed in here, but I'm not actually going to do this because I already have too many accounts. So instead, I'm going to jump over to the login screen. And of course, now I can just log in with my password. But one of the interesting features we also have with Globus Online is the support for other login providers. So, for example, I can log in using any InCommon university credential. So any campus that's a member of the InCommon Federation, I can use that to log into Globus Online. I can also use things like my NERSC account or my Blue Waters account or my Argonne ALCF account, my Exceed account, right? These different identity federations that I can use with the service. So let's do that for the fun of it. So I pick that, say proceed, and what it'll do is redirect me over using standard InCommon tools to the University of Chicago Shibboleth login server. Type in my University of Chicago CNET ID, my standard University of Chicago ID, and it'll redirect me back to Globus Online. And the first time it'll say, well, I don't recognize you. What do you want to do? And so what I'll do here is say, okay, let's bind this, if I can type my password, to my Globus Online account. And so from now on, I've made this little change to my profile now that I've added this InCommon credential so that from now on, I can log into my Globus Online account with single sign-on from my university login. So just to show that, I logged out, logged back in, goes to University of Chicago. Now there's even a cookie set from the Shibboleth server. Takes me right back to Globus Online, and I'm in, right? So that's the first thing, is good integration with our community's security systems. Now let's actually do a transfer. So I'll go to the Start Transfer page, and the first thing I need to do is select where I want to do my transfer to and from. And we call these endpoints, right? An endpoint is simply a storage system that's running the appropriate Globus Connect software to connect it to the Globus Online account, the cloud. It's a very simple naming scheme. Anybody can create endpoints. So I've got a few of my own under this account, Tiki Hash, whatever. The Exceed resources are out there, or NERSC. Brian mentioned in his talk the ESNet, Grid FTP servers. There they are, those three, right? So the model is, you know, anybody can create these endpoints, and so let's go ahead and pick one. So I'm going to start with the University of Chicago's Research Computing Center endpoint, UCRCC Midway. So this is just a HPC cluster at the University of Chicago running a GPFS file system, standard local stuff. Now, the first thing you see here is it was able to log me right into this, and this was because we can provide end-to-end single sign-on with InCommon. So we were able, because I logged into Globus Online using my University of Chicago account, I was able to go back to a University of Chicago endpoint without having to type in my password yet again. So I'm able to go in there. I can browse around inside the folders, see what's in here by double-clicking. I can Shift select gives me regions, option select, right, all the standard things you'd expect of a file browser. So let's go ahead and do a transfer. So let's go to a second site. So let's go to NERSC, NERSC DTN. As Brian talked about, this is their data transfer nodes. And in reality, what's behind here is not just one Grid FTP server, but a whole array of them. I think this one, if I'm not mistaken, is about 10 Grid FTP servers all connected to that cluster file system so that we really can derive the high bandwidth to these systems. So now here, the first time I go to it, I have to log in, right? It's not that Globus Online has any special permissions to use my account at this site. So this is what we call activating an endpoint. I'm logging into my NERSC account and getting back what we call a proxy credential, a short-term ticket, security token that Globus Online can use to interact with the NERSC site. And so now I'm logged into two different sites with two different security systems. And now I can do transfers. So I can pick a couple files. Let's take this file 2 and 3. I can set some options at the bottom if I want. I can give it a name. My first transfer is just a label. If I want to instead do synchronization, you know, rsync style synchronization of only things that have changed, I can turn on these options. So these three together are about the equivalent of rsync minus AV minus minus delete if you're an rsync fan. Right, so you can do only a sort of mirroring of data to keep things updated and only move what's changed. An important feature we have on by default is verify file integrity. You know, one of the hard lessons of the big data community over the last decade or two is that systems are not reliable. Right? TCP checksums are not sufficient to detect bit errors in your transmissions. file systems fail, RAIDs fail, bits get corrupted, and often in an undetected manner. And so one of the things that we do by default is do an extra level of file integrity checking. So after we do the transfers, we'll actually reread all that data back, do MD5 checksums, verify that it's all right. And this is a good example of why this is important is if you saw the announcement from Exceed recently about finding a router bug that was corrupting some traffic undetected on the network. Well, we looked in our log, sure enough, we saw it, but we had already automatically corrected for it for our users. So we were able to handle these sorts of issues easily. So selected a few options, selected my source, I want to take it to the destination, press go. So what's happened here is we've now handed off the request to Globus Online. The transfer's not necessarily done yet, but we've handed it off. I can go look at how it's progressing by look at the view transfer panel. So I can look in, like if I want to drill in and see more, I can click on either the label or the progress bar, see more information about what's happening. I can even drill into very detailed event logs. If there's any faults that happen along the way, I'll see all of that. So I have access to that for problem diagnosis and things like that. But what we try and do is just get things to work, you know, keep trying until things happen. So that's the first transfer, right? From no account, get an account, log into two different endpoints, and do a transfer, right? Of course, that's between existing centers, right, that already have installed the necessary software, that are running these DTNs, this sort of stuff. Of course, that's not the only places I want my data. I also want it in places like my laptop, so I can do uploads and downloads, or servers that I own. So let's do my laptop. As I mentioned, Globus Connect, we have a family of tools called Globus Connect for connecting your systems, including a desktop version where we have versions for Mac, Windows, and Linux. And so all I do is create an endpoint with this. So I'll give it a name, my laptop, generate a setup key for it. Let's go and grab that. Let's download the software. We'll install it, simple drag and drop installer. All right, clear a few of our windows here. Go ahead and start it up. And the one question it'll ask me is for the setup key. Type, paste that in, okay. And we're now up. Up in the menu bar, now we see an additional icon that's very similar to the Dropbox model, right? I've just installed an agent. It's not a client, I never interact with it directly, but it's an agent that connects my machine to the Globus Online cloud. I can set some preferences in it. So, for example, I can say what local file systems it has access to. By default, it's my home directory, but denying access to my security files, like my .ssh and .login. If I've got, say, a USB disk or something that I want to add and make that available, I just select it, add it to the list, decide if I want it read-write. Right, so very easy to configure this for what you want. But having done that, it's now just an endpoint. So I can say, let's go to my laptop. Select it. There's my laptop directory, which should look an awful lot like that. A little different sort order, but it's my laptop. And now, again, I can do transfer. So I can say, let's take this. Oh, what should we do? Let's take a couple more files. Let's take this couple I don't have here, 2 and 3, and we'll download those. And we can do recursive transfers as well. So I can actually do a more bigger one for the fun of it. Let's take this My Project and put it into my temp folder in my home directory. So let's go ahead and fire that off. All right, so now we've fired up a second transfer, and it's off and running. So we can just let that run in the background. Some point here we should see the globe G starting to spin a little bit. I'm not sure if you'll be able to see that over the screen share. But we're now off and running with a second transfer, now this time to my own laptop. As mentioned, we have Linux versions that you can install. Even if all you can do is SSH to a machine, you can SSH in, put on the Globus Connect as yourself. It doesn't require admin privileges. It can run behind NATs and firewalls. As long as it can do an outbound connection, it's good to go. And so you can basically get these machines connected. As I mentioned, I'll mention in a moment, we also have a server version that's good for if you want to install it for all your users to make it work just like the UCRCC or the NERSC machines you saw. So this one looks like it's almost 20,000 files in this recursive directory, and it's off and running, downloading these to my desktop. So that's the second transfer. Now for the last bit to show you before I wrap up is, as I mentioned, there's two major use cases. I've shown you the transfer amongst my accounts, but I also want to be able to do sharing, right? I'd like to be able to say, let me go over to a different endpoint that has the newer version of the Globus Connect software of GridFTP with the sharing turned on. It's in beta testing right now, but it's the same endpoint. It's still the same GPFS file system running at University of Chicago, but this time what I'd like to do is say, I want to take this My Project folder and actually share it out so that another user, and I've got another user running over here in another browser called logged in as SJT, completely different Globus Online user with no access to the University of Chicago machine, no login or anything, but I want to share this My Project folder with that other Globus Online account. So all I do is go into the dropdown, hit share, give it an endpoint name, so we'll call it Tiki Share. And what I'm doing here is effectively think of it as a virtual name. It's a mount point, effectively, where I said, create this new virtual endpoint, this new shared endpoint called Tiki Share. But really, what it is behind the scenes is that UCRCC sharing my Tiki tilde directory, my project folder, right? So that's the only, so that's sort of a virtual change rooted name for that. And just to see that it is an endpoint, now I can go to it, just as any other endpoint. And that should look a lot like that because they're the same bits on disk. But having done that, I can now trivially share it. So I can go here, type SJT, add read-write access for SJT. So now let me jump back over to that SJT account where I'm logged in, go to tiki hash share, and now I can get to that same directory. And I can do things here now. I can do transfers from here. I can create folders. You know, everything that I could do by whatever permissions I've been given, I can do with this endpoint, right? So for example, I can go off to, say, Exceed Trestles, which is another supercomputer in San Diego that I'm already logged into here, and take, oh, I don't know, let's take this, oops, take this GCMU cheat sheet and transfer it across. If I refresh it, there it is, right? So again, with just a few point and clicks, I was able to take files from the University of Chicago cluster, create this export, the shared endpoint, make that available to other users that do not have an account on that University of Chicago machine and share it out. We can also do this with groups. So for example, we have a whole group management system built into Globus Online where I can define groups, like I've got this Globus team group. I can say who's members, and you know, SJT is a member of this group. Have subgroups, I can have settings about group visibility and member visibility, all the things you'd expect, but really focus on letting users define their own groups, their own project teams, so that you can do things like sharing, right? So now if I jump back over here, go back into that share panel, I'll remove the SJT access control and instead add access control for that Globus team group. There it is. You know, you can see the members again, SJT's in there. Add it, so now I've given read permissions to that. Can jump over here, refresh, and we still see it again, right? So very easy to share out. I can also share out subfolders, all that sort of stuff with this Globus Online sharing capability. So let me jump back to slides and just wrap up my section here. So as I mentioned, you know, I showed you the Globus Connect, right, the end-user desktop version meant to run behind NATs and as me without admin privileges, all that. We also have a version called Globus Connect Multi-User, which is designed for your servers, and it can install multiple GridFTP servers. This is the package that makes it really trivial to install what you need to into your DTN to connect it to Globus Online. It supports a zillion different flavors of Linux with native RPMs and Debian packages. You know, very easy to install and use. A lot of instructions out there at our support site, support.globusonline. Next, you know, a few other just highlights of Globus Online is I mentioned earlier that Globus Online also has REST APIs, and this is part of also a longer-term strategy of creating not just end-user software as a service that people can use for data transfer and sharing, but also platform capabilities so that if you're building your own web application or your own non-web applications, that you can really easily integrate the same functionality, all of the identity management and federated identities and group management and file transfer and sharing, all of this you can really easily integrate into your own applications using our REST APIs and some of our web capabilities like OAuth. And so, for example, the K-Base project from DOE, the systems biology project, is using this for all of their identities and groups. So the same groups I can define for sharing, I can use those same groups for access control to the KBase data. University of Exeter has created an interesting campus archive service where they use us for transfer but also collect metadata about it. And we've got a product that we call Globus Genomics that we're introducing that based on Galaxy for genomics analysis on top of this same platform. But I won't go into that in any more details. So the last bit I'll mention then is that, you know, we, as I mentioned from early on, we're a nonprofit service provider to this community, right? We're part of the community, but a big challenge in this community is sustainability, right? If you've been in this community creating software at all, you know that can be a big challenge of how do you make sure you have essentially the money to last long-term and keep providing high value to the community. And so what we're doing with Globus Online is introducing sort of a freemium model. Some of the services that you saw, transfer, synchronization, creating your endpoints, all that sort of stuff is and will remain free for the nonprofit community. But if you want to do the sharing, and then we also have some capabilities for peer-to-peer transfer and sharing directly between desktops and laptops with Globus Connect, we have what we call our Plus plan. And so you need to be a subscriber to that. And we have two models. You can either get it yourself with a credit card. We'll be rolling that out literally in a few weeks here. We also have a campus version, and we're working now with Internet 2 to make this available through the Net Plus offerings, where basically what you can buy as a campus is a bundle of Plus subscriptions, some extra management features. So we have tools that allow the administrators of an endpoint to see all of the transfer traffic to and from their endpoint. So you can see what's going on with your DTMs, see all the faults if people are having trouble, and help your users, you know, basically provide better support. And then this also provides commercial quality support, as well as some branding. We have the ability to do skinning of our sites. You know, so for example, Blue Waters has skinned our site. NERSC has a skin of our site that integrates it even more tightly into their environments. So with that, give it a try. If you have any questions, don't be shy about going to our support forums. A lot of good documentation facts out there. Support a ticket, but give it a try and let us know how it goes. So with that, I'll turn it back over to our next speaker.
All right. Well, thank you, Steve. And we do have two questions that are in the chat room. If Raj or Vass wants to take a look at those two, we can answer those. But I think we'll turn it over to Andrew right now to start with his presentation. So, Andrew, are you still on?
Yes, I am.
Okay.
Okay, thank you.
We can hear you and you have control.
Excellent. So I am a user from one of the national facilities, and I was asked to talk a little bit both about the research that I'm doing, the type of data that we're collecting, as well as our experiences with data transfer and how they've evolved over time. And so I'm a plant physiologist, and I'm using one of the national users' facilities to look at aspects of plant water transport, both the structure and function of this tissue within plants, using X-ray microtomography. And I'll give a bit more detail about that as we go. So I have the privilege of working under two bureaucracies. So I am actually a USDA. I'm a federal scientist with the U.S. Department of Agriculture and the Agricultural Research Service within that. But my lab and my office are actually embedded on the University of California Davis campus, and I'm an adjunct professor there. And this actually becomes important in terms of transfer with IT, because I have two layers of IT that I'm typically dealing with, of the computer purchasing, but then I actually have all of my network access through the department in the home institution of UC Davis. And it's actually been quite easy for us with Globus, which I'll get to at the end. So the overarching goal of my research program is to improve water use efficiency, and it actually looks like it got cut off here on the slide, but it's improving water use efficiency for irrigated agriculture, particularly in California, and I work primarily in vineyards, but also in almond and walnut orchards. And we do everything from studying water uptake at fine root level to the transport of that water once it's inside the plant through the vasculature and delivering that to the leaves where it's needed for photosynthesis, and also quantifying water use at the whole vineyard and orchard scale. And so what I'll be talking about today is focused on the transport aspects of this. And this slide, it has layered over top of itself. But so essentially, What happens inside the plant is the water is absorbed initially by these fine roots and then is transported just like our own vasculature, but in rigid tubes called the xylem. And the xylem is essentially all the wood in your furniture or in your houses. It is just a series of these really tiny microcapillaries that deliver the water up to hundreds of meters in some cases for redwoods and eucalyptus trees. And that water is actually pulled along by evaporation of water at the leaf surface. So there's holes in the leaves, stomata, that open up, and water evaporates out of there in exchange for carbon dioxide to make sugars. And that pool is actually transmitted all the way back down through the plant because the water molecules are cohesive and stick to one another and can withstand pretty high tensions. And so the water is actually pulled in through those roots generated by this evaporation at the leaf surface. What's important here is that it's actually considered metastable, and so those water columns can break. And so that's one of the things that we're studying at the user's facility. And so we actually are a user at the X-ray microtomography beamline at the advanced light source at Lawrence Berkeley National Lab, around building up on the hill if you've ever been out there, and we use beamline 8.3.2. which is the microtomography beamline. There's a lot of life sciences users as well as geologists and soils folks. And essentially what we end up with from this is we have an X-ray beam and we spin our sample through there, and we originally started on woody stems, dried woody stems, and you can see on the right-hand side of this slide an example of the stack of images that we get from this. And then we use off-the-shelf engineering software to recreate that 3D reconstruction in 3D space and look at the voxel space. So the next slide is actually an example of some of the xylem networks that we see from these dried stems. And in 2 days' time, we can generate up to 2 terabytes and approaching now 3 terabytes of data over a 48-hour period. So we're starting to generate a lot more data as we go on with this, depending on the number of samples that we're working on. And we originally started, as I mentioned, with dried samples, but then on a whim we put a live grapevine in there. And so most of our current work now is looking at the functionality of that vascular system in a living plant and looking at the formation of cavitation, of how drought stress induces these air pockets inside the vessels themselves. And on the left-hand side there is a living grapevine that was scanned, showing how vessels cavitated in purple, were the earliest ones to cavitate, and then how it spread from that point, so how these air bubbles spread throughout the system. And you can see that there's a whole bunch of functional vessels as well still remaining in there. And then we're also now working on grapevines in particular have this remarkable ability to repair those embolisms once they're in the system. Our own vasculature, we have to grow new veins to get around it, but grapevines actually fill those tubes back up. And so that's a quick overview of the research that we do there. And just to give you an example of how we have dealt with it, and I think it was covered very well by Brian and Steve, we are one of those typical users that have dealt with a whole bunch of drives being shipped around via FedEx and carrying it by hand because proximity for us hasn't been too bad down to Berkeley from the Davis campus. But essentially we have a stack of hard drives in our lab that we still have things backed up on. And then we eventually moved to the Drobo system, which is what the end station was using there, and that's a built-in backup system. But even that had some problems for us of where we would put data on, and if you tried to copy too much, the whole thing would just sort of lock itself up, and the manufacturer doesn't tell you that. And then you can't get data in or out once you're to that point, so it doesn't really help you in terms of backup. So we would originally capture our images at the advanced light source and do some bit of the on-site reconstruction and transfer it to a hard drive there via USB, and we would just leave that drive there for several days. And there would be other users coming and going and a pile of these things sitting there for a whole bunch of users. We would eventually pick up that hard drive and then take it back to Davis and transfer it to the Drobo and use lots of prayer to hope that we weren't losing that data over time. And still much of our data is actually stored in this way in our lab. And then finally, we have recently, probably in the past 6 months, transferred over to Globus. And I really think of this just like an old school FTP site, and it really functions as easily as that used to. Steve's description of it, my experience with this has been as straightforward as Steve described it. We haven't gotten into a lot of the sharing, but we are doing that because I have a colleague over at University of Florida, and we've been trying to figure that out. So this has actually been really important to me to even just see what Steve demonstrated earlier this morning of our capabilities with that. But this has simplified everything so that we don't have to do all the on-site reconstruction at ALS. We can bring a lot of that back much easier and deal with it here now on-site at Davis. And so that's my experience.
All right. Well, thank you, Andrew. We still have one question that is outstanding in the chat room that we will get to, but I'm going to turn it over to Yasmin now for the final presentation.
Good afternoon, everyone.
Can you still hear me, Yasmin?
Yes, I can hear you. Can you hear me?
I can hear you, and you have control.
Thank you very much. Well, thank you, everyone, for joining us. My name is Yasmin Carter. I'm at the University of Saskatchewan, which is actually in Canada, so I'm bringing a bit of a cross-border perspective to this. I am a bone biologist, a researcher who specifically studies bone at the submicron and micron level. And actually what you can see here is very similar to what Andrew was just describing, microtomography of the vasculature system. But this is actually the vasculature system within the hard tissues of bone. So what you're looking at is an inverse image where the canals are represented in these larger gold. And then these small dots are actually the cellular spaces, the spaces within the bone that the cells which represent the mechanotransduction system, this is where they live. Now, this is very important for human bone because it's at the cellular level that bone is able to register what's going on in terms of the actual loading that the bone is undergoing and also any diseases. So it's really our main hope for discovering what's going on in terms of things like osteoporosis and osteoarthritis. But we've always been restricted in our ability to see it because using traditional histological techniques, we get a very restricted field of view. So we then moved on to medical CT. And obviously, a lot of people have had medical CTs. If you break a bone, you get something like the image that you're seeing on your the left of your screen here. And these CTs are actually, they have a resolution of around one millimeter. Now, we stepped down to micro CT, and we have micro CT in our lab, which produces about a 10 to 50 micron resolution in terms of the voxel size. So this is a three-dimensional pixel, the same that you would get out of your camera. And then on the far right, you can see the synchrotron radiation-based micro CT that we take. This is actually a terrible image. It's a really bad scan, but never mind. What you can see is that we actually then step down to a much higher resolution. Now, the majority of my synchrotron radiation micro CT research is conducted both at the Canadian Light Source here in Saskatchewan and at the Advanced Photon Source in Chicago, well, just outside of Chicago in Illinois. This leads to some interesting problems because it means we have a lot of data that we're moving around and we're having to move it cross-borderly. So here you can see an example. These are about the quarter of a data set to show you. We end up with an average data set of 1,800 pixels across and 900 slices. So when we go on beam time, we may have 4 days of research, and we will collect hundreds and hundreds of scans. So much as everyone else has described, we were having a really lovely time because each one of our samples, as I say, runs between about a gig and 3 gigs per scan, depending on how much of the sample we study. And we can average, initially when we were first running, about 70 scans, and now we can do upwards of 100 and sometimes up to 200 scans per run at beam time. So our average take-home data set actually ends up being about 3 to 7 terabytes. And this is an interesting experience when you've come from Canada, you're paying usually we've brought a number of students, and we're paying for hotel costs, per diem, and essentially what we would have to do is we would do 4 days of beam time, and then we would plug in a number of USB drives, as you've seen before, and then we would sit around in Chicago for 2 or 3 days waiting for the data to transfer. And obviously this is a great expense and is adding a lot to grant expenditures, which was not happy about. And also it's a waste of everybody's time. So once we started using Globus, which I think was about a year ago now, we moved on to Globus, that's just completely removed those requirements for us. So we have, with Globus, we have tremendous ease of use. We can finish up our beam time and literally fly out back to Canada a couple of hours afterwards, and we're able to return to the lab and just start transferring data as and when we need it. We can have partial transfers, which is really great because it allows us to actually start analyzing specific data sets, choose what we transfer and when, and then just let everything else transfer while we're working on the data set that we were particularly interested in. We've reduced our requirement of hard drives tremendously. In fact, we have a filing cabinet full of hard drives that we used to use. For us, of course, the no time delay is a really big thing. And also, easy recovery of lost and corrupted files. I've had experiences of USBs breaking and losing information. And so we've had a lot of chance with Globus to go back and say, there's something wrong here. Could you re-upload the file? You know, let's do this again. And we've actually managed to regain data. The other thing, of course, is that our data is accessible anywhere, which is hugely important because we can, we have a lot of collaborators all over the world, including Australia. So we can take a scan in Illinois, come back to Canada and say, work on our portion of that, but the Australians can also have complete access. And for us, a big thing that Globus is really providing is security in terms of the data that is transferred. We do work, our scans are of human remains, and there is a lot of requests, certainly from the autopsy side of things, that these specimens are treated with respect, and that, of course, no one has access to them other than those people who have been granted access. So to know that we can electronically transfer data, but that it stays completely secure, is a really big bonus for us. And yeah, I think that's pretty much our experience with it. The one thing I would say is that I am in no way, shape, or form an IT expert, and this is so incredibly easy to use. I've had students that are that get their own account. I can give them access to their data and their data only for scans that they're interested in looking at, and it really partitions the data and gives everybody access to only what they need. So, thank you.
Thank you very much. So I'm going to unmute the participants at this stage, and we will open up the floor for questions if you have them for Brian, Steve, Andrew, or Yasmin.
The conference has been unmuted.
Okay, if there's no questions, we thank you all for joining, and we will make this available after the fact so that you can download it, and we welcome you to send us any feedback as well. Okay, thank you all.
Thanks.
The conference has been muted. Thank you. Please stand by.